So this panel is about the intersection of our two favorite things, technology and international geopolitical upheaval. And the million-dollar question is, what happens when the technology disappears? What happens when the internet goes out? What happens when satellite phones become monitored? What happens when mobile phones and cellular phones cut out? What happens when the technology that everyone, activists, revolutionaries, ordinary people, use to communicate, disappears? What happens from there? What changes can be made? What can be done? And what are the alternatives? And we've got a great panel here to discuss it. And it's going to be really interesting, but first, quick things. The hashtag for this event is #PoundOverthrow, so if you're tweeting, please use it. We'll be monitoring the conversation, bringing up questions to the audience, and taking it from there. Next off, we've got a bunch of very hardworking volunteers running mics around for the QA. So if everyone could move up closer to the front, that'd be awesome, because they've got a lot of floor space to cover, a lot of people to cover, and being able to have everyone closer for them, that would be totally awesome. And next off, speaking of QA, we'll be speaking for about 40 minutes and then taking questions from the audience. And when you're asking your questions, some great advice I heard in an earlier panel, imagine your questions are being asked on Twitter. Keep them short, sweet, 144 characters. We've got limited time, a lot of people on stage, and we want to make sure the best possible stuff comes out. So, let me just give quick introductions, and we'll launch into things. My name is Neil Ungerleiter. I'm a reporter over at Fast Company magazine, and I cover the intersection of technology and politics around the world. Next to me is Jamal Tajani of Internews, very talented reporter who actually, busy dude, last couple months alone, been to Libya, Tunisia, Syria, a couple other countries I'm also forgetting. Next to him, we have Asiel Ahmad, and he works at two great organizations. He works over at Access, a global movement for digital freedom, and Votify, a new political startup here in New York, believe in D.C. Next to him, we have David Gornyaski of Anchor Free, the world's most popular VPN, and they have millions of users worldwide. And as far as the tech side of things, enormously knowledgeable, enormously talented, has good advice to share. And next to him is Sonia Ginnins-Otley, the manager of the Business Human Rights Program over at Yahoo, who has a very busy job managing the competing demands of business, human rights, and net freedom all over the world. So before we go into questions, I'm going to have everyone just speak a bit more about their work. And Jamal, over to you.
Again, I'm Jamal Dejani, Vice President for the MENA region for Internews. Internews is a global media development organization. We work in approximately 60 countries around the globe, empowering local media. Our motto is local voices, global change.
Hi everyone. My name is Asiel Ahmad, co-founder of a political polling company, a startup in D.C. called Votify. I'm a fellow with Access, an organization dedicated to protecting and preserving global internet freedom. When the internet gets shut down or when mobile phones get shut down, we try to mobilize people around the world to restore access and to hold accountable people who cut off access. And just in terms of my experience on the ground, I spent about 3 or 4 years working in Southeast Asia on political campaigns, and I'm not only a advocate of global internet freedom, I'm also a victim of when those privacy securities and freedoms are infringed. So I've seen all my text messages and phone calls transcribed and handed back to me in very unpleasant circumstances.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Gordyansky, CEO and founder of Anchor Free. We're a Silicon Valley-based company that makes Hotspot Shield, which is the most popular security and privacy tool in the world. Originally built to make Americans secure and private online, it evolved to enabling freedom and privacy in places like the Middle East and China, and has become one of the most popular tools to bypass censorship and to gain information in regions where it's limited. We have about 60 million people around the world that have installed the product, so have a lot of interesting data and interesting trends that we see on usage and just how freedom, security, and privacy spread from country to country.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sanjay Gittins-Ortley. I work with Yahoo. I manage our business and human rights program. It's a program that we set up in 2008. It's the only program of its kind in the ICT sector. It's a standalone program that essentially looks at ensuring that we integrate human rights decisions into our business operations. Besides that, we also work with the business to figure out innovative solutions to human rights issues and to challenges faced by both our users and the content that they're trying to reach and to read and to access. So we really work with trying to figure out how, using our platform and our reach, we can really think about human rights issues in a company such as ours. I'm going to talk a little bit during this session about the role of companies in engaging responsibly in challenging markets, and also some of the situations that we faced and the solutions that we've come up with.
Great. And again, the hashtag is #PoundOverthrow for questions. Just realizing now that's a really, really cool hashtag, but we're going to kick things off with the most cliche question imaginable. What role did technology play in the Egyptian Revolution? Dumb question. Everyone here has been asked it a million times and answered a million times, most likely. But how did Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube affect the revolution in Egypt?
You're right. This question probably been asked a million times, and we have to remember one thing, you know, when we start talking about, because I don't want to take away from the Egyptian people, I don't want to take away from the Tunisian people. People make revolutions, not social media. I mean, that's, I think, the most important thing that we should all remember because of their sacrifices. And certainly the January 25th revolution in Egypt was an incredible achievement by its people and a truly inspiring example of the power of peaceful protest. Before I get, if you allow me quickly, before I get start talking about social media, it's very important to remember that there was a transformation that happened in the Middle East, which I call the media revolution that preceded those physical revolutions, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, etc. And that happened about a decade ago with the coming of satellite TV, with the advent of Al Jazeera, when borders started to be shattered because of all these different transmissions that you've had all over the Middle East. Someone sitting in Morocco can watch in real time what's going on in Beirut, Lebanon, or someone that is sitting in Jerusalem can watch what's happening in Gaza, etc. And that's really significant because in rural areas, like, for example, in Egypt, you have, more than 80% of the population don't have access to the internet, but they do have access to satellite TV and they have access to radio. And so the information they get, you know, and let alone they don't have access, for example, to smartphones, they have a lot of mobile phones. So it's a multiple sources that brought them these different information when the Egyptian satellite channel was focusing its camera on traffic during the revolution on, you know, the height of it on January 25th, telling the world that everything was normal. The people in the south of Egypt in places like Aswan watched what's going on at Tahrir Square through satellite channels like Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera. But social media, I mean, coming back, played a very, very major role. I mean, that's in amplifying the revolution itself, and it was very critical because it was critical to spread the cognitive dissonance by connecting through leaders and activists to ordinary citizens, rapidly expanding the network of people who became willing to take action. So what was going on got amplified very quickly, and you could attribute this to several factors that happened on the ground, from horizontal expansion to really getting activists connected, or, you know, as a major example, what happened when, for example, Mubarak decided to turn off the internet, that backfired on the government because it became a cause. You know, censorship became a cause, and that happened through the social media, you know, which compounded basically the effects of the revolution. It got people mobilized not only within the country but also externally. Everyone trying to help in to help everyone inside the country.
And totally shifting gears to the other side of the world for a minute. In Cuba, Twitter recently announced a SMS option for Cuban Twitter users to contact a British telephone number, which would post their Twitter messages to the service by SMS. And it's an international call, which means it's limited to a very small segment of the Cuban population, the ones who can afford text messages going to a foreign country. That leaves the bulk of the country's, not just Twitter users, but internet community, pretty much entirely out of the water for using that service. And my question is, what can American, and not just American, but worldwide internet firms, .coms, and service providers who operate in parts of the world where their service are restricted for political reasons, what can these organizations do to make access easier? Sonia?
That's a great question. First, before I get to that, though, I just want to build on something that Jamal pointed out, which was that when the government in Egypt took action against something that was used by everyone, it became critical, because by blocking the internet or by taking action against the entire segment, passive users became very active because of the impact, the direct impact that it had on them. And I think that that is where activism and the use of media, recognizing that social media can be used quickly, has an impact and a reach and an influence, but it was when it went beyond those who were activists and trying to tweet or trying to post pictures about what was going on. When that expanded, that was when it really became, it went beyond viral. So I think that that's something that's really important for us to note. Going back to Neil's question, I think for us, and I think for companies in general, not just American companies, I think globally, when companies are designing or devising products, it is often the case that these products are not devised, or these tools are not devised with activists in mind. So if we recognize that the starting point is that a tool is designed to upload a picture quickly or to allow communications to go faster, and people want to bring these things very quickly to market, and then these products become used by activists or people who stumble upon activism and realize that these tools are really great for communicating or for free expression issues, then it becomes an issue for companies. And companies such as ourselves, but I think companies around the world, have really been grappling with how do we, recognizing that this might not be what the tool was originally set up for, what should be our obligation? For us, it's become a little easier because we're part of something called the Global Network Initiative, which encourages us, and that's something I'll speak about a little further, but it's something that really encourages us to think about those issues, to think about free expression, to think about threats to privacy and censorship. And because it's something for us and for the companies that are part of the GNI, the Global Network Initiative, they, and that includes Google and that includes Microsoft, they have incorporated that, and we've done that as well, into how we do business and into how we develop products and tools. And I think for other companies, and perhaps David can jump in, other companies, startups, companies around the world probably need to start thinking about things like that as well.
Yeah, I can certainly jump in. I think there's a huge demand in the world for a way to stay private and for information. There are 600 million internet users today that live in regions with censorship. So 600 million people can't access basic things that we're used to. And that's a huge, huge demand, right? And so in my mind, it creates a huge opportunity for somebody to come in and create a supply for that demand and say, hey, here's 600 million users. Should companies care? And I think the answer is absolutely yeah. The company should care. It's a huge market. And freedom is the demand. Privacy is the demand. And somebody's got to come in and cater to that. If we do that, we try to do that for our users, users of Hotspot Shield, of our application. But I think every company, whether we're talking about the social media companies or the search engines, should realize that this is not just something that's kind of a defensive thing they have to do. It's a huge opportunity. And I think when they realize that, then it becomes more than a charity. It becomes more than something that somebody down in the organization deals with. And it becomes a real business initiative. It becomes something that, you know, the CEO is concerned about, not just the legal guys. So that's when it becomes really, really interesting. Again, 600 million people have the demand for security, privacy, and freedom. We've just got to provide the supply.
If just I add one thing quickly, because I do feel, I mean, you know, when we talk about censorship and digital security, et cetera, that we're only addressing third world countries and what happened in the Middle East and so forth. But at the same time, you know, let's take into a factor that democratic countries continue to set a bad example when it comes to that by yielding to the temptation to put security above other concerns and by adopting disproportionate measures to protect copyright. Technical service providers are under increasing pressure to act as internet cops. So, you know, it's not just an issue of the third world or Egypt or Tunisia. It's, I believe today, if you go to Reporters Without Borders, there is a new survey that came out. Of course, it puts Bahrain and Belarus to the top of the offenders list. But then if you look at the semi-offenders list, you'll see many Western countries, and it's very important to pay attention to this as well.
Thanks, Jamal. And I'm just going to quickly switch over from being the moderator to actually speaking about that for 1 second. At Fast Company, I wrote 2 weeks ago about the Homeland Security Department's new social media monitoring program. DHS hired General Dynamics, a large military contractor, to monitor Facebook, to monitor Twitter, to monitor YouTube for thousands and thousands of keywords. And at a congressional hearing, the supervisors of DHS who were handling this project seemed, in my opinion, to be dangerously unaware and massively uninformed of their own program and what they were actually doing. It was less a case of maliciousness than, well, total and utter stupidity on their part in terms of how to manage a government project. But the amazing thing I found is that they were monitoring not in my backyard neighborhood initiatives. They were monitoring church groups and PTAs whose Facebook posts were public. They were monitoring community organizations' Twitter feeds in regards to local politicians, state assemblymen, and state senators, not even national politicians, which, in my opinion, was done mostly to secure more funding. But the fact is that even in the United States, similar internet surveillance is being done to that in other countries. And my next question, and anyone in the panel is free to take it, is what happens when internet surveillance is done here in the States by overzealous government agencies? What options do ordinary internet users have to keep their email and their social media posts secure?
I mean, I can somewhat answer that. Users can do, I mean, a very specific answer is users can use HTTPS and encrypt. They can use a VPN, encrypt their emails, encrypt their communications, and ensure that they're private online. So if you're using Hotspot Shield, for instance, your IP address becomes private, all of your communications become encrypted. But I wanted to say something else also, that it seems like everything in life is challenge and response. So every day we have challenge, some kind of challenge, and every day we've got to respond to it. And so the response is the key here. So, you know, in Egypt or in other places, there have been a number of challenges that people have stood up to and responded to. And the response has been usually the people win. And I think you could see that recently through the fact that SOPA was never passed here in the United States, right? There was a lot of people that went out and lobbied against SOPA, and finally, you know, it died. So I think probably everyone in this room was happy about SOPA not passing. And if you're not happy about it, come talk to me afterwards.
Great.
I just want to add to this. I do believe also this is, I mean, the internet also, you know, we were talking about this earlier in the waiting room. You know, you have to take your own, you know, responsibility also when it comes to digital hygiene, and also for developers. I mean, we've had a discussion about, you know, people coming with all kinds of tools and apps for communications, but do developers put the interest of the user first, or do they only just want to get as many subscribers as possible before, you know, you download a new app? I made a comparison. We require out of, and thanks to people like Ralph Nader, you know, people forgotten about him, but when the car industry began, there was no safety issues, and now every car company is required to have a certain standards for safety to protect you. But when it comes to using certain tools, I mean, are there restrictions or requirements on those developers to make sure that your communications are going to protect your identity, protect your privacy, et cetera? And that's a major question that has to be posed to the industry.
Yeah, I think another issue here is that there's a process of education. I mean, this technology has developed so quickly, and I think it's now that I read a survey from Pew that now about 20 or 30% of people on Facebook actually clean out their profiles from time to time, delete pictures, untag pictures. So I think there's a realization that this is not a passive activity, this is an active process. One of the things that Access has tried to do is put out a number of publications that basically help people in different areas to understand the security implications of what they're doing and how to act in a responsible and safe manner. So we just put out a manual on how to prevent or protect yourselves from denial of service attacks, and we've translated that into, I think, 7 or 8 languages. We had a general document on just general safety using cell phones and using social networks. So I think education is the big thing. And then, Neil, your earlier point just about how, and Jamal, your point about how we have to be careful also in countries like the United States. I mean, you know, at some point we have to abstract from technology and realize what are the underlying principles of democracy, of freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom from search and seizure. These are actually the objectives, and we have to probably use technology in increasingly interesting and innovative ways to defend those rights. And I think SOPA and people are the perfect example. I don't think Congress had ever received more calls in a single day than they did on that day. And if that's not an indication to where power can shift if organized in an appropriate way, then I think the next few years will be interesting in how the internet community mobilizes to defend our rights to have a free and private internet.
And also, you mentioned earlier your work over in Asia, and you've had some experiences in countries where internet security and telephone security concerns were way, way different than here in the U.S. And my question is, how do you teach best practices for security in countries where the risk of surveillance is much more likely than here in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Malaysia, it certainly wasn't as dire a circumstance as it probably is right now in Syria or it was in Egypt. So we were, I would say, relatively careless. We were that way because there was very seldom a case where people will disappear, people go to jail just because of a phone conversation. I mean, those things obviously are used, and there's a fear factor. I think what happened in Malaysia and in 2008 when I was there and what's happening across the region is that people are getting over that fear factor, and so they just don't care. You know, they're willing to take the abuse because they know that there's an intermediate step towards freedom. And I think that's amazing. I mean, I think that is not something that you can really predict. But once it's there, then what I saw was a whole new generation of younger, previously politically inactive people getting involved and figuring out new ways to use all these tools that some ways are the same as we use here and some ways are very different. And that's the great thing about, at least to some level, these platforms which allow for a degree of innovation and crowdsourced sort of activity. So I hope that answered the question, Neil.
Hell yeah. And David, my question is regarding the issue of developing software that can be used for human rights issues. As far as software solutions, developers don't come cheap, coders don't come cheap, engineers don't come cheap. How is it even possible to turn human rights and security for people without much money into a profitable business?
That's a good question. I think, I kind of come back to a bit of what I said before. If you've got a big enough market, you can cater to that market. You could turn anything into a profitable business as long as there's enough demand for it. And, our challenge to the human rights community for a while has been, hey, let's make freedom and human rights more than a charity. Let's make it a sustainable, profitable business. Let's have freedom be scalable and profitable. You know, let's cater to this huge demand for freedom and privacy. This huge demand that in emerging markets is 600 million people, but then there's also the Western world, which demands that as well. And let's cater to those people and let's figure out a way to monetize that. And monetization happens through multiple ways. I mean, you could charge 99. You know, we charge 99 cents for our iPhone app. Our desktop product is free, but you can upgrade to a paid version if you want. We have an ad model. There's multiple ways to monetize. And again, I just feel like as long as you're catering to a huge audience and you're solving a real problem, you'll figure out a way to make money. And that's what we're trying to do. And our point of view is, let's change the world, let's have some fun, let's make a real impact, and we'll make money as we go along.
I'd like to add to that. I think one of the things that, for us, I think it's true, and I believe it's true for a lot of the companies that are in this space, we're in the business of providing content and access to content, and users, the trust of our users is really integral to what internet companies do. And if that's what your business is about, I don't think it's not a nice to have to ensure that there's free expression or that the user's privacy is secure. I don't think that's just, that's in the abstract things of, we'd love to do this. I think this is really integral to what you do as a company. So it's part of your business model. It has to be. With that being said, I think it's quantifiable because it really does affect your bottom line. If you're in the business of providing access to information and content. If users don't trust you, they're not going to come to you. They're going to go somewhere else where they feel that that trust is there, and that safety and that privacy is there. So I think, and as users, and going to something I was said earlier, I think there is a responsibility for the users as well, not just the activists who are in this space already and who are aware of what could be happening, but there is an obligation both on the companies but on the users to be aware of what steps should be taken by themselves to protect their information, to protect, as Jamal said, you know, their digital hygiene. It's something that has to be really, really critical to what is done. So I think it's something that's quantifiable because there is a bottom line effect, but it must be something that's integrated into what you do as a company.
David, one comment I would make is that I think it's great that you as a businessman have internalized that goal. And I mean, I'm sure there are many other people who have internalized social responsibility or socially conscious goals into their business model. I don't know that the corporate world necessarily would do that in a sort of aggregate way unless there's demand from the people. And I think that's where I think it's really interesting to see how, for example, when the telephone networks were shut down in Egypt, Vodafone's actually a very large minority stakeholder in the telco, the largest Egyptian telco. And we actually went after them. We wrote a letter to the CEO and we said, this is unacceptable that you allow this to happen. And, you know, you have terms of service with your customers that say that you will not shut down service and all these things. And we actually went to their shareholder meeting last year, stood up and asked the question and got a response. So when shareholders see that their bottom line will be impacted, then it's not so much making profit out of human rights agenda, it's retaining profits that they might lose to other competitors who've internalized these goals. And I think that's a more likely path to getting this concept of internalizing human rights as a business objective, because the bottom line will be affected.
I come from the nonprofit world, so I have a whole different model of thinking. I mean, I feel when we talk about global human rights, this is an inalienable right to everyone, and it should be available for these tools should be available for free for everyone to use, you know, to download. And we should take into consideration when we talk about something in the West how others could use these tools, you know, culturally, linguistically, etc. I mean, there are all kinds of things available. You know, you can download security in a box that's available for people to acquire, you know, the skills for circumvention tools, etc. It's available online, but until recently, it wasn't available in so many languages. Now it's available, for example, in Arabic. So people in the Arab world, I mean, not everyone speaks English or French, you know, North Africa. So when these corporations, you know, the for-profit corporations, developers, I think they need to take a social responsibility approach in making, you know, when we're addressing issues around human rights, that has to be really not only provided for everyone to use and make it very easy for them, but also to develop some kind of interaction and relationship with the people on the ground who need it the most, so they can be adapted to their needs.
Great. And continuing with that, right now the big story as far as telecom restrictions around the world is the national filtering system being built in Pakistan. This was just announced several weeks ago, the Great Outcry. And Pakistan is attempting the most ambitious internet filter since the Great Firewall from China. Over 150 million websites will be blocked. And there has been national outcry in Pakistan over this. Civil society and corporations worried this is going to cut into their bottom line are very angry right now. But the Pakistani government has been pressing ahead due to what they consider to be domestic security concerns. And my question is, what happens when you have a national firewall? What happens to businesses in these countries who depend on viewing American and European websites for business they can no longer access and the economy suffers? What happens when the businesses are forced to turn to activist methods in order to operate day by day?
Great. I think I want to bring up the example from Egypt here, because I think it was January of 2010, it was 2011, January of 2011, when the Egyptian uprising started. We saw first that people fled to the social networks really quickly to try to share what was going on, and then Egypt blocked the social networks. So everybody fled to us, to Anchor Free, to get our tool to bypass the censorship and still continue to go to Facebook and Twitter. So then Egypt blocked the internet completely, just shut it down. So it was really interesting. We saw our usage go in 72 hours from 100,000 users in Egypt to 1 million, and then the internet went completely dark. And we saw our usage fall to almost zero. There was no internet in Egypt. But not completely zero. People continued using it. And we couldn't understand why or how. How's that possible? There's no internet in Egypt, and yet there are still users. Turned out people were using dial-up modems, mobile networks, cell phone networks, all kinds of different satellite to still get to us and then get to social networks. So it's amazing how people will always find a way, no matter what, to get to the content they want, to get to the information they want. And I'm often asked the question, you've got 30 engineers at Anchor Free, and China or one of these, or Iran has like 50,000, right? So how can your 30 engineers combat 50,000? And my answer to that is, it's not really 30 against 50,000. It's my 30 engineers plus 600 million people that have a demand for this against the 50,000 engineers that Iran or China puts against us. So realistically, we've got a lot more people. so we tend to usually win.
And if we talk about the example of Egypt, also when Mubarak cut off the internet, he effectively forced people to the street. So there is something, there is a correlation between digital service shutdown. What happens? It forces offline engagement. So that can happen in Pakistan. We've seen it happening also in Iran. By the way, you mentioned Pakistan, but Iran recently has been working on its halal internet, and you could all read about it. I tweeted about the halal internet, but it's a way to basically put everyone in one realm and one platform so they can monitor you all at the same time.
I'm actually from Pakistan. My parents are from there. I was born in the U.S., but we go back a lot. And the government in Pakistan right now is in a precarious situation. I would actually in many ways compare it to where Malaysia was at a few years ago, where the government is losing legitimacy in leaps and bounds because of inefficiency, corrupt management of the economy, you name it, and they're guilty of it. The president right now is known as Mr. 10%. There's an opposition candidate who is starting to generate a lot of support among a younger generation of politically disaffected Pakistanis, and largely through mobile messaging and social media. Now, internet penetration in Pakistan is very low relative to many other countries. But same was the case in Malaysia. And what happens actually is word of mouth. I mean, there is an online to offline transmission of information. So we would have some very famous bloggers go to the most rural areas of the country and be celebrities. And we were quite surprised to see that, because people print out articles, they share them. There's a sort of, people will read an article and text somebody about it. So, like you said, the idea that you can, that a country like Pakistan, which can't manage virtually anything other than probably the military, can the civilian government really pull something like this off, and are people not going to find a way around it? And ultimately, it will get people even more upset, and I think hasten a swifter end to that that regime, or that way of thinking that, we can still oppress people just simply by playing games like this. So I think it's a leading indicator of the end of that system of governance.
And also, we're running short in time, so I'm going to ask you one follow-up question before we switch over to the Q&A. But in your experiences in Pakistan and Malaysia, what lessons do you think young net activists learned from the 2011 revolutions?
Well, I think at the very basic level, it's an inspiration. You know, campaigning in Malaysia in 2011, even though, you know, it's thousands of miles away from the Arab Spring, you're talking about a Malaysian Spring. So there is a, you know, there is a sort of viral effect of these sentiments through the web. In terms of lessons being learned, I think, you know, you can't, once you go and dig deep into how Egypt was possible and how some of these situations came about, you know, it's not just about the last step, which is being online and getting things to go viral and stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of lead up that goes into people who are organizing on the ground day to day. And I think that story is being told in a lot of great ways now that we've had time to reflect. There's a great documentary that came out, I think just recently, by someone who was in Egypt up until 3 months before the revolution started, documenting what was the movement that became the January 25th movement. And I think understanding the way in which people were organizing each other, organizing and linking up from cities to cities and using very sort of traditional techniques and, you know, helping each other out. I think that's the real lesson to learn, which is that, you know, these are tools which enable certain behaviors, but those behaviors are, you know, the understanding of what it means to be a citizen in democracy and to claim your rights and to defend those rights through your own sacrifices. I think that's the lesson. And I mean, look at Burma now. You know, I mean, a year ago you would not have thought that Burma would be having elections, that Aung San Suu Kyi could become an elected representative in the government. And, you know, that's inspirational. I think that's directly related to what's happening everywhere else in the world.
Censorship itself becomes a cause. I mean, that's a fact. And high profile censorship incites circumvention skills acquisition. I mean, those have been studied, and that's the net result. That now, if you go, you know, if you talk about circumvention or digital security in the Middle East, or even just as simple the subscription, for example, to Facebook in January of 2011 went up in the MENA region by 30%. So, you know, these revolutions activated a lot of people in the region, got them to hone their skills and wanting to be engaged online.
Great. And we're going to switch over to the Q&A part now. And again, we're running short in time, so keep the questions Twitter length, nice and short. And also, I've been asked by the nice South and by Southwest people that you don't ask the question until the mic comes to you. And the mic will be coming to the back to the front of the room. And this is going on audio, so having the microphone by you will be pretty damn awesome. And all right, we are ready to start.
Hey, guys. So I'm Brian Connolly, Small World News. I know some of you. Hey, Asa. I think so. It's nice to talk about how, you know, yeah, okay, yes, it does incite increased circumventions, tools, and usage. But at the end of the day, the large majority of people in MENA are not having access to internet tools. And I think we're seeing in Libya right now the fact that, you know, a Kalashnikov, I would say, is a much more effective tool, unfortunately, at this point. It's much more, not effective, but accessible. So how do we get more people who are not literate, people who do not look like us, right? I would say that the majority of the people we hear about who are tweeting and doing work in Egypt are analogs to upper middle class, educated, active Americans, but in Egypt. They're not the people in the Sinai Peninsula. They're not the people in Burgal Arab. How do we get, you know, how do we assist them as well?
Well, I mean, early on, I spoke that it is a, you know, the flow of information is multiple sources. And I said before there was these revolutions, the most important thing that happened in the entire Arab world was a media revolution, which happened more than 10 years ago. And to reflect on what you've just mentioned. The people in Sinai, I've been in the desert, not just in Sinai, and other places, and I've met Bedouins who have converted a frying pan into a satellite dish, hooked it up to a car battery, and they were watching, you know, TV. Also, you know, people are resourceful. And you're right. Egypt, the rural areas outside Cairo, Alexandria, and the major big towns, you know, internet penetration still is very, very limited. So at the end of the day is how to give people the skills and empower local media. Not only then when we talk about journalists, I'm talking about netizens and activists and, you know, the average youth in schools. So how to communicate to the outside world and how to use different platforms for communications. And as far as Libya, because I just came from Libya, and you're right. Might is right. And, I happen to be at TV stations who, under Gaddafi, you had two TV stations, basically satellite TV stations. One ran by Gaddafi, the other one was ran by his son, Saif al-Islam. And now they have more than a dozen and over 100 radio stations. Still, they need a lot of skills and learning. And they have internet. Internet is not censored, at least yet. So my question is, yes, we have chaos and we have mayhem, but what's better, right? Gaddafi era or the kind of the chaos era that is now?
I think also the least common denominator here, I mean, what's the biggest social network out there? It's text messaging still, I think. And, you know, I think we'll find over the next few years amazing innovation coming from these parts of the world on how to leverage text messaging for building capacity and whatever civil society institutions. I mean, there was a great example in Lebanon or I'm not sure which country, but they basically just announced that everybody who goes into a polling station will be photographed, or the ballot boxes will be photographed, and it dramatically reduced, and they were going to send those photographs by text message or something, and people spread that news around through text messaging, and it dramatically reduced fraudulent ballots. And so text messaging, like Yushahidi's platform, they use that to actually gather the data. I think we'll see really interesting things, and it'll come from developers in those countries who understand what needs to be done to reach those rural areas.
And just to add to that, I mean, if you look at the, as you mentioned, the internet penetration is low, but the mobile penetration is extremely high and continues to grow. So the implication there is that you have to try and devise ways to make mobile platforms really effective and really innovate on those platforms for activists and for activists who are just stumbling upon it.
One other thing is that we've seen radio be very effective in regions where there's no access to the web, and I think for sure mobile is huge. So here's an idea: if somebody wants to go and do it, maybe the only problem with the radio, it's one way, right? You get information in, but you don't get it back out. So maybe some text message to radio app, right, where you can text the radio station and get their get your text to be broadcast. That'd be interesting. If somebody wants to go develop it, who knows? Maybe.
Thanks, David. Access actually is quickly developing little pilot projects to work on packet radio to transmit, you know, small amounts of data across borders where, you know, if the internet is shut off, you put up some towers and you can actually send free information in and out of the country. So these are opportunities, and if people are interested in that type of stuff, we'd love to talk to you and figure out ways where we can fund projects and experiments in that area.
Cool.
Great. And also, we actually got a question over Twitter that is pretty good for you. The big question, what's the best way to educate users that lack security practices from a single user can put large groups of people at risk?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I think, you know, we're making a real big push for all of our training materials to be translated. We have partners in, I think, over 100 countries now that, you know, in small ways are trying to disseminate that information and provide it to people so that they start to adopt. But Like I said, I think this is something that's happening in the United States now. May be a little bit difficult to expect it to happen immediately around the world, but there's obviously a lot of work that I think the private sector can do in as they provide these tools to also provide a mechanism for the training on the safety issues and the personal privacy issues that come about it. So it's going to probably come through NGOs, through the media in general, and also through partnership with the corporations.
I think there's also a huge amount of influencers online. We've seen dozens of YouTube videos made about our product and translated into different languages, and we haven't made a single one of them. It's just people that are passionate about the product, making videos, spreading the word, why do you need security, why do you care about being private online, why is this important to you? And we're seeing some of these videos. So again, we've never made them. They're about us, but we've never made them. We don't even know the people that made them. But we see some of them have over 1 million views. So it's... I think that it's not just NGOs and companies. I think it's users of the products that are spreading the word a lot.
And don't wait until there is a catastrophe or an emergency. This is the most important thing. These things need to be developed and put in place before something happens, before a disaster happens. Just to give you a quick example. Now, you know, when I was in Jordan, they've had less than 10,000 Syrian refugees. Now, people say the numbers have swollen to be more than 80,000. And some of the activists who managed to make it out of the country just basically to save their lives, I've read some, you know, I've had some conversations with some others. I've read, you know, through some colleagues of mine. And one question was posed to them about, you know, what we're talking about, digital hygiene, digital security. Are you paying attention to this? Because this is what the Syrian government is basically taking advantage. In fact, they're getting help from the Iranians to, you know, locate you, etc. And the common answer that was coming from them, we don't care. We don't care. And I was surprised. And why you don't care? Because they said, you know, they were saying, you know, my neighbor, my friend has been, had spared with his own life. Why should I care about my own life? So when you wait to the last minute, those tools or those ideas don't work. Or they lose their effectiveness at a time of an emergency because people are less motivated and they're very activated, driven by passion, and so on. And so anything that comes up as far as education, it has to start early on and preparedness before an emergency hits.
And we have a question over there.
It's actually in reference to the very excellent question that was just asked about how users can be educated. I just had a couple of tips because I think it's such an important question. So one, there's an organization called the Global Network Initiative that companies are a part of, but also NGOs are a part of. And I think figuring out a way that users can go directly to participating NGOs like Human Rights Watch, for example, is a part of it. I think that's important. There are also a couple of other organizations. There's Global Voices Online, and I'm sure there may be someone here from them, and they're an aggregation of bloggers and people from really around the world. And I think that's another resource for people, for users around the world to be educated. And then finally, there's an organization called tacticaltech.org, and that's an incredible organization that really focuses on protecting users and giving tools so that users are educated about what the exact implications of what their actions are online. Again, I think that's a critical question. And so I think specific tools, I'd love for people to know that there are specific tools out there that address that issue.
Thanks.
Okay. And we've got some questions over here.
Hi, thank you. Catherine Harrington, Women's Learning Partnership. So we've seen the power of these tools for mobilization to topple the tyrants, but the challenge that we're particularly facing, especially with our partners in the Middle East, is once, you know, informing democratic societies now, the power vacuum's getting filled by conservative forces like the Muslim Brotherhood that have the grassroots face-to-face connections on the ground. You mentioned the large number of people that are illiterate. So how can these tools be leveraged to actually actually engage the masses in democratic political participation and protect the rights, women's rights, minority rights. Thank you.
I think these are being used. I mean, the example that you mentioned, the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, they also access these tools, and they are also using Facebook, and they're using Twitter to mobilize. So you cannot pick and choose or cherry pick who is going to be your audience. And on top of that, they have the mosque as a platform. Every Friday, they have a captive audience to address. We've seen it not only in Egypt, but also why the Islamists are in power in Tunisia. And I've had conversations in Tunisia why people were shocked and surprised in Tunis after the elections, because everyone assumes that, you know, the you know, people are going to be thinking the same way that they're thinking, and people are going to have to elect in Tunisia a progressive government, etc. And the Tunisians themselves, they were shocked that the Islamists came into power. And the answer, when they did a study, it, in fact, the Islamists didn't have the highest numbers per se, but the liberals had all their voices divided because they've created 104 parties versus one party, one ideology. So it's more of a political issue than the tools themselves.
You know, I got to jump in here.
Okay.
I'm just dying. you know, we've provided a space now that's democratic. You know, we have to allow that space to sort itself out. I mean, for 50 years, the Muslim Brotherhood was an opposition party and under extreme duress. And so obviously they have a feeling that they have a right to now come in and do something. And if you say, well, you know, everybody's free except this group or that group because they don't fit with the expectation of what a liberal democratic society should be, then you just end up going back to dictatorship. So this is going to take time. It normally takes several successive electoral cycles to sort this stuff out where you get coalitions to build. Mm-hmm. And I'll give a quick example in Malaysia. The Islamic Party in Malaysia always advocated for Islamic State, and they were always in the opposition. In 2003, they did this crazy thing where in classical Islamic law, there's a tax that you impose on non-Muslims. I mean, it's a very sort of old-school approach. They tried to impose that tax on one of the states they controlled, and they lost the next election. It was just a ridiculous move that they made. Now they're in a position where they're in a coalition with other more liberal parties, and they've dropped Islamic State as their objective. They're talking about welfare state. They're talking about social justice. This is really what you want to have happen. You want parties to engage with each other now that you've created the space and work things out on their own. And, you know, Rick Santorum is probably the closest to the Muslim Brotherhood candidate of the United States than anyone else that we've seen in quite some time. So, you know, this is, again, this is not a question of East-West. This is a question of giving a space for Rick Santorum's ideas to be juxtaposed with everyone else's and let the people decide. If we end up with Rick Santorum as a president, it's because we have a democratic system, and he won, right? So,
I just want to add to that question and this discussion. That's something, I think that was a really great question, because it's something we've been thinking about a lot at Yahoo, really trying to figure out how, with our platform and the reach that we have, and seeing, you know, women really being involved in the uprising throughout the region, the Middle East region, how do you take it one step further beyond being there on the streets agitating for change into actually being involved in the new structures that are being developed? So earlier this year in January, we actually held a summit. We convened about 250 panelists and attendees from the region just to really sit and think and share what could really be, first of all, how they were using the social and digital media platforms to create change in their communities, but what they really wanted to see from companies, whether it be tools or products or help or advice, and really focusing on specifically the issues related to women's rights in terms of governance, in terms of journalism, entrepreneurship, and really doing that to think and to create. It's something that we hope to do, not hope, we will be doing it in Brazil later this year, and we hope to do it in India this year as well. So it's something that we've been thinking about, and the other companies were involved with us in really doing that as well. So I think you will see, and you have seen companies doing that. It's called Change Your World. And I think companies around the world are thinking about how can we go one step further. So.
Great. We've got like 90 seconds left, so last question.
He's been trying.
Hello? Okay. I come from nonprofit and social justice background as well. Two-part question. If it's for profit, if it's not free and open source, how can people and justice come before profits? And second, if it's a closed source application, how can activists truly trust what's going on inside the tool?
It's a good question. I think a lot of the trust factor is an important question in using a tool. I think there's two questions here, so I'll try to answer the first one. I think people basically, as far as trust, people trust things that that are used by other people that are audited, that have had security audits or privacy audits, and that are have been reviewed by professionals. So certainly, you can select tools that have been reviewed and have been approved as being trustworthy. You can also see, a really easy check is just go online and see which tool has the most downloads. And we've done that many times. We see. Our tool's been downloaded more than 60 million times, for example. I think the nearest competitor to what we're doing has had less than 50,000. So I think user approval is a big part of the trust. And as far as your question about the private sector, how can you trust a company in the private sector? I think that it's interesting, there's this new concept now, the B Corporation, right? And that's this concept of having a corporation that's for profit but yet has a social goal, a social mission. So that's kind of new, and I personally find that pretty interesting. We're not a B Corporation, but I think that's just an interesting new phenomenon. I think we'll be seeing more corporations turn into B Corporations because creating a social impact is just as important or more important than making money.
I just want to add one last thing. So we're part of something called the Global Network Initiative. And one of the aims of the GNI is to ensure that companies, when they're operating in markets that are challenging or when they're faced with threats to user privacy and to free expression, they have a code of conduct that they follow. One of the key aspects of the GNI is an assessment process and an accountability process. So later this year, in a few months actually, a report will be released saying how the member companies of the GNI, what have they implemented, what processes have they implemented to ensure that they're in line with the GNI principles. And the GNI principles, or the code of conduct, are based on international human rights standards. So I think that companies that are part of the GNI, and as of right now, it's Google, Microsoft, ourselves, Evoca, and WebSense. Companies that are part of that, they're going to be assessed, and that is going to be public. We hope and we encourage other companies to join. It's a multi-stakeholder initiative. So Internews is on it. Investors are there. Human rights groups are there. So it's very collaborative. It's shared learning. It's shared experiences. And it's about companies who are in challenging markets going forward together and having a roadmap that they can use. These companies all have different business models, but if they all agree to these standards, I think that's a step that's very, very important for companies.
Right. And we still have a lot more questions, so we're going to be here after the panel. Actually, you had your hand up for a while, so quick question, man. Quick question.
I don't have a mic, so I'm just going to say this out loud.
Wait.
I got a mic, so I'm going to say it through the mic. My name is Tariq. I'm from Cairo, Egypt. I've been very active in the revolution, obviously, from day one, as we all have been. Also work in social media, so I'm very active on social networks. And it's very interesting to hear people from different parts talking about us. So I think... A lot of things to say, but I think what I've really learned over the past year is that it doesn't matter about the tool. The tools aren't important. What's important is getting the information across. In Egypt, Bluetooth is massive, for example, and people come to Egypt, you get into any cab, and it's just very easy to exchange stuff via Bluetooth and landlines and SMS, as you've said, which is a very clever statement you made. And I think we need to focus a lot more on free and fair flow of information. And I think what I'm trying to say is this information gets everyone aware of where they are and why they're being exploited. I'm sorry. Why they're being exploited, why they're being oppressed. And this needs to be applied in the West more than the East. However, it's just like in the Arab countries, it's very obvious because there's a dictator killing people, and so it's very obvious you have an easy enemy. But in the West, there's this idea that you have a democracy and you have different ideas, when at the fact of the matter is the free and fair flow of information has been surpassed by the governments and authorities and corporate America, for example, in the case of the U.S. In the case of the U.S., that gives the impression that there is a democracy, when in fact it's useless because you don't have the social justice and freedom and bread, which are the main demands by anyone anywhere in the world, whether in the Arab world or the U.S. Thanks.
Great. And we've got to wrap things up, but we will take additional questions to answer by Twitter at #overthrow. And I want to thank you all for coming out, and I think our panelists did a great job.